Okay, good morning, everybody. It is Thursday, October 22nd, 8 a.m., and we're doing a review for the second exam for Chem 30A. And what I've got to start us off with is a copy of what Trista put up for her exam review. So let me pull that up and we can take a look at that. Oops, that's stopping mirroring. That's not. Okay. So this is what we've got this morning for the exam two study guide that Trista put up. And we can hit any and all of these topics and whatever. So the way that I generally like to do a review is I don't come in with a set agenda. I know I've said that a whole bunch of times. I've written it in emails. I've put it everywhere. So what I really like to do is work off of your questions because it's your review. It is for you guys to help you understand things that you're having problems with. So I think of it sort of like extended office hours, but with me here to make sure that you're in the right track and that you have the right information and that you're set to handle what the exam is going to throw at you. So this is the study guide that Trista put up, and she has some slides up as well. But I thought when I looked through the exam study guide, it was much more complete than the slides. The slides were just some topics as well. And so I read through these last night. We've got 16 different things here and it covers quite a bit. I didn't see the chapters. I was looking to see what chapters it was going to cover. And I thought it was, well, I don't see it. Maybe it was back. Just to be sure that we knew what chapters it was.
It's 3 through 5.
3 through 5. Okay, I was going to say 3 through 5, but then that seemed like too small an amount of material, but that sounds right. All right, so chapters 3 through 5. And my iPad is going to be a little glitchy with this. It doesn't like this thing that I've posted in, which is an image, and it thinks that the image needs to be written on yet, which it doesn't. Okay, so we have, and let's just read through these real quick. Know how to use group numbers and period numbers in the periodic table. And what information do these provide regarding the number of valence electrons, location of valence electrons, and charge of the ion? Compare covalent and ionic bonding with regard to electron transfer, or sharing and type of elements involved, metals and nonmetals. Write the correct formulas for the two products of a double displacement reaction. And she has here in words, the double displacement, iron two chloride reacts with sodium oxide to form iron two oxide and sodium chloride. Compare and contrast the naming rules for ionic versus covalent compounds. Be able to correctly write the formula for an ionic compound given its name. Know how to crisscross charges. Draw the Lewis dot structure for a molecule of H2O. What is the shape of this molecule? Is this molecule polar or nonpolar? Do the same for BF3, CO2, NH3, PCl3. This is something that particularly for my sections, we haven't dealt with. So she hasn't had a lab where we deal with this yet. Really, this has only been dealt with in terms of the lecture component. So that's something good to talk about. And also, especially polarity, polar versus nonpolar, is generally a confusing topic. Explain electronegativity and how to determine if a bond is polar, nonpolar, or ionic. Understand the trend for electronegativity in the periodic table. Those kind of go hand in hand. What is the definition of a mole? What is the relationship between moles and atomic weights listed on the periodic table? What is Avogadro's number? Know how to use it. Calculate how many atoms are present in 10 grams of carbon. How many moles is this? 5.5 times 10 to the 23rd atoms of sulfur is how many moles of sulfur? How many grams? Review some problems from the lecture notes and homework and be able to convert between the number of atoms, molecules, grams, and moles. So stoichiometry, in a word, is what that line is. Know how and why to balance equations. See Lab Activity 12 and Chapter 4 for practice. Briefly define redox reactions. This is something else that I haven't discussed in my labs yet because we haven't had a lab on redox reactions. Be able to identify oxidation and reduction reactions as well as oxidizing and reducing agents in the equation. What is meant by the term theoretical yield? Be able to solve calculations involving actual and theoretical yield. Give a balanced equation and available moles of a reactant, or given, predict the amount of a product made or other reactants required. Okay, so that's everything she's got in there. That's quite a bit through those three chapters. And let me make sure that I can see all my windows, that I've got my chat up so I can see you guys. And I've got my other window up where I can see all of your little icons, which works for me. All right, anybody have any idea where they want to start with all of this? What's the biggest topic that seems to be scaring you in this exam, or the thing that you just haven't figured out how to do yet?
I would like to go over polarity.
Okay. Let's start by me checking in with a few things on polarity. So let me go and grab a periodic table and bring that in first. So polarity is a big topic. Not that there will be a lot of questions on polarity, but it's definitely one of the topics that people have some of the biggest trouble with. Now, why did that bring that into photos? That should have brought that in into notability. Nope, wrong thing. Okay, when we look at a periodic table, the electronegativity trends go across so that we get more electronegative as we go across the periodic table in this direction. That seems like that needs to be a bigger line. So electronegativity trends in this direction and trends in this direction, with fluoride or fluorine being the most electronegative element on the periodic table. And so this is increasing electronegativity. And what we have is a, I'm gonna switch to black. What we have is a man-made determination here that we start with what we call the difference in electronegativity. So delta EN. Difference in electronegativity is defined as the absolute value of electronegativity one for element one, subtract electronegativity for element two. And if we look at delta EN in the difference in electronegativity, up to and including 0.4, we say is nonpolar. Between 0.4 and 1.7, we call this polar. And greater than 1.7, we call it ionic. And so the values come off of a table, and to ask you any sort of question regarding electronegativity of a bond itself, then she needs to give you electronegativity values. For instance, hydrogen here is 2.1 and carbon is 2.5. And so if I want to investigate the electronegativity difference between carbon and hydrogen, and I want to know about the carbon-hydrogen bond, hydrogen being 2.1, carbon being 2.5, the difference in electronegativity is simply 2.5 subtract 2.1. I always just do it so that I put the larger number on the left, so I don't have to worry about the absolute value, but theoretically you could do it in any order. And this comes out to 0.4, and this is nonpolar. So that these values, when we think about what these values are, let's see how much of this I can scoot down. Oh, it takes the whole thing. That's actually kind of nice. These values for nonpolar, polar, and ionic, it is zero through, I want to say less than, so zero less than 0.4 is nonpolar. Let's say less than and equal to. From 0.4 up until 1.7, I will say including 1.7, this is polar. And then greater than 1.7, that's ionic. So that 1.4, even though we fell directly, excuse me, the 0.4, even though we fell directly on 0.4, we call that nonpolar. Now, we can do that for any bond, and we can talk about whether a bond is polar or nonpolar or ionic. But then when we get into a molecule, which is what I'm guessing your question is asking, is that correct? Looking at molecular polarity?
Yes.
Okay. So in molecular polarity, then what we have is a series of questions. And we set up a flow chart for molecular polarity. The first question we ask is, are there polar bonds in the molecule? Or does the molecule contain polar bonds? Essentially, we're asking delta electronegativity greater than, so we want greater than 0.4. And if the answer is no, then the molecule is nonpolar. If the answer is yes, then we need to ask one more question. We're not quite done yet. So the next question that we ask is the molecule symmetrical? And usually we leave it at that. We say, is the molecule symmetrical? But I don't think that's sufficient to ask the right question. Is the molecule symmetrical such that the dipoles cancel? And in this question, what we're asking is, so to put it into sort of a little bit more of a mathematical terms, is the molecule an AX3, an AX, let's start with AX2, AX2, AX3, or AX4, where X's are all the same? And we can show that in those cases where the X's are all the same, the dipoles will cancel. So if the answer to this is yes, that all the X's are the same and there are no lone pairs, then the molecule is nonpolar because all the dipoles cancel. And I can show some examples. If the answer is no, then the molecule is polar. Okay, and this also includes all of the AX2E2, AX2E, anything with an E in it, anything with lone pairs in it falls into the polar side. AX3E. So all of those guys fall into the polar component. And let's take a look at a couple of molecules and we'll see why this is the case. Okay, so let's do the Lewis structure for CO2. This is a really common one to look at. And we can review Lewis structures at the same time, which is kind of helpful. So first thing that I tend to do with Lewis structures is I do an electron count. I list each one of my elements. I list how many of them there are. I multiply them by the valence number of electrons, and I get the valence number of electrons from the group numbers. So carbon is 4A, So it's got 4 valence electrons. And oxygen is 6A, so it's got 6 valence electrons. So I'm coming out with how many valence electrons this whole thing is going to have. So these are my electron counts here. So I've got 4 and 12 for a total of 18. Then what I do is I take the central element and I connect it. And usually we tell you what the central element is. I connect it to the outside elements with at least one bond. I then take on the more electronegative elements and I give them a full octet. Then I check to see, have I used the right number of electrons? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16. Actually 18 was my wrong number here. Somehow I can't do basic math, should have been 16. So we'll correct that. All right, I've got 16 electrons. So my number of electrons are correct. However, when I count octets, oxygen here has 2, 4, 6, 8. The octets for oxygen are good. Carbon only has 2, 4. Carbon octets are not working. So we're gonna have to come back and fix that. The oxygen on the right, 2, 4, 6, 8, that's okay. But to fix the carbon, it needs 2 more pairs of electrons. And so to fix that, what I'm going to do is I'm gonna push in 1 pair from each of the oxygens. And in so doing, I will come up with a new structure which double bonds the carbon. The oxygen now has remaining electrons. So what I did is I check electron count, electrons used, that was good. Check octets, that failed. We check the electron count again, and then we'll check octets again. So my count, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16. I'm good on my count. Oxygen has 2, 4, 6, 8. I get to count all of these for oxygen. So oxygen has an octet. I get to count all of these for carbon. So that's 2, 4, 6, 8. So carbon is a check. And the last oxygen, I get to count everything bound to that oxygen. And that is 8, and that is a check as well. And so my octets check out. So this is my Lewis structure. So we'll take, and now that I've drawn all over that Lewis structure, we'll represent it down here. Okay, so this is my good structure. And from that good structure, I can go up and I can ask the question, does the molecule contain polar bonds? Is there a delta electronegativity difference greater than 0.4? Well, delta electronegativity is going to equal the electronegativity of oxygen subtract the electronegativity of carbon. And those electronegativities, oxygen equals 3.5 and carbon equals 2.5. So my difference in electronegativity is going to equal 3.5 subtract 2.5. That's going to equal 1.0, which is indeed greater than 0.4. So this is polar. The bonds are polar.
Excuse me, yes. How do you know those values for oxygen and carbon, the 3.5 and the carbon 2.5?
Oh, that is such a great question. I haven't memorized. But for you, they are in your textbook on a particular page, which I cannot tell you. They'll be in the chapter with the electronegativity, but I haven't looked at the book to know the exact page number. But there is a table in your book that lists the electronegativities. And the other thing that I can do is I can pull them up. Let me see.
So on the exam, will she give us those values?
She must, yes. She is not expecting you to memorize those. They will be given on the exam.
Okay, that was my only real concern.
Okay, so maybe I don't need to pull them up then. We'll just keep going forward. But yes, you must be given those values because we never expect students to memorize them. Although what I will say, if you go back to the periodic table, they go on a pretty nice trend at least for the elements that she's probably expecting you to know, boron starts off at 2.0. Come on, stop moving around. Boron starts off at 2.0, carbon at 2.5, nitrogen at 3.0, oxygen at 3.5, and fluorine at 4.0. And so it's a pretty nice trend for these main group elements here, and hydrogen then at 2.1, which is the only one that you really need to try to put some brain power into memorizing. But like I said, she'll list them for you. Okay, so we have a polar bond. So what does that mean for our molecule? Well, that polar bond, when we calculate the difference in electronegativity, the difference in electronegativity is actually a vector. A vector is something that has direction and magnitude. Direction and magnitude means that the size of the bar that I'm drawing, which goes towards the partial minus and the partial positive, determines how big the dipole moment is. So I could draw a dipole moment that might be 0.4 and one that might be 1.0, and the size difference tells you how big the dipole moment is. The direction goes along with the molecule and the bonds that we are looking at, such that if I look at carbon and oxygen, this carbon is the less 2.5, the less electronegative, oxygen at 3.5, the more electronegative. So oxygen steals some of the electrons, carbon is a little left out, and I draw the dipole moment in the direction of the bond. So that's how I know which direction the bond goes, arrow towards partial negative. For the other side of the molecule, it is the exact same dipole moment, but in the exact opposite direction. And so what happens is, if I think about this as 1.0, and I think about this as minus 1.0, I'm thinking now about placing this on an XYZ coordinate system. So this is the Y direction and the X direction. And I have a vector that goes out, let's change color, that goes out 1.0 in the positive direction and minus 1.0 in the negative direction. Those two vectors are in direct opposition and directly cancel each other such that the net vector is zero. When I add them together, what I really do is I add 1.0 and minus 1.0 and that equals zero. So the net vector equals 1.0 minus 1.0, which equals zero. And so there is no net vector. And that means that the molecule is nonpolar. Okay, let's see how that lined up with this, the flow chart that I gave you before. Does the molecule contain polar bonds? The answer was yes. Is the molecule symmetrical such that the dipoles all cancel? Those geometries where the dipoles cancel are AX2, AX3, and AX4. All X's must be the same element. If that is true, then the molecule is nonpolar because the dipoles all cancel. This geometry that we are looking at that is carbon dioxide, this is described as an AX2, where A is the central element and X equals an atom bound to central. And both of the X's are the same. Let's compare that to another molecule that that has a different symmetry, but the same geometry. So let's look at.
So as far as shape goes, that would be a linear.
It is.
Okay, and we're going to look at another linear in this example that you're providing as
that
well?
That is correct. So I want to look at another linear that is not symmetrical.
Okay.
So in this linear one, we could go through the entire forming of the Lewis structure, but I can also shortcut it and tell you that this is the Lewis structure. And so without going back all the way through, just so that we can compare differences in geometry. Now, we have two different types of bonds. We have the carbon-hydrogen bond, and we have the carbon-nitrogen bond. So the carbon-hydrogen, the delta electronegativity difference, equals 2.5 for carbon and minus 2.1 for hydrogen, and that equals our 0.4. That's nonpolar. For the carbon and nitrogen, the difference in electronegativity, nitrogen is 3.0, and carbon is 2.5. And so this is a difference of 0.5, and that is polar. And so what we have in this molecule is a dipole moment where the nitrogen is more electronegative, and the carbon is partial positive. And in that, the dipole moment runs this direction, and this dipole moment is a 0.5 dipole moment. In the other direction, between the hydrogen and the carbon is more electronegative than the hydrogen. And so I have a small dipole moment that runs this direction, which is 0.4. And they're running in the same direction. They're not in opposition at all. They do not cancel. So if I were to do it mathematically, what I would say is on an XYZ axis, I have two dipole moments, one that's running this way at 0.4 and one that is at 0.5. And when I add those two together, because they're going in the same direction, they equal a net dipole moment of 0.9. And this is the net dipole. And that means that the whole molecule is polar because the dipole moments are not canceling and there is one polar bond. So this one molecule is polar. Now it is an AX2, but X is not both the same. The dipole moments only cancel when the X's are the same. And so going through our flowchart, if we use our flowchart and look at that, what we would say is for the molecule we just looked at, does the molecule contain polar bonds? Yes. Is the molecule symmetrical such that the dipole moments all cancel? Is it an AX2, AX3, or AX4 where X's are all the same element? The answer is no. And therefore the molecule is polar. So you don't need to do the math. You don't need to sit down and write all the dipole moments. I feel like I need to do that to show you why this flowchart is working. But all you need to do is rely on the flowchart, and the flowchart will take you in the right direction every single time. Does that make sense? Is that helping?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, and we can take a look at some of the other polarities or some of the other geometries, and we can review other geometries really quickly. For instance, we can take a molecule which is CH4. This is a molecule which is tetrahedral. So that's my tetrahedral geometry. If we asked, is the molecule polar? In fact, let's make a list. We'll do a couple of different molecules and we'll ask for all of these, is the molecule polar? Or nonpolar? So we have CH4. Let's do CH3Cl. This one again is a tetrahedral. let's do some trigonal planar or trigonal pyramidal. So we'll do NH3 and we can do NH2BR. And these guys are trigonal pyramidal. So tetrahedral. And both of these trigonal pyramidal. So classifying these, what I do is I classify these as an AX4. It is a central element, A, with four things bound to it. The next one is also an AX4. I find it easier to classify them a central with four things bound to it. The next one is an AX3 with an E, where the E is about the lone pair. And the X's, this is a good way to do it too, that we can see the X's and where they align. And the A element being the central element. So everything sort of maps out. This one is also an AX3E. And we don't distinguish between the different X's if they are the same or different when we write out this. But when we ask, is the molecule polar or nonpolar, we first have to distinguish if there are any polar bonds in the molecule. So this one we've seen already. We know that the difference in electronegativity for the carbon-hydrogen bond equals 0.4. That's nonpolar. So this was supposed to be the question of polarity, polar or nonpolar. Looks like I was saying that this is polar, which is not what I meant to do. This was supposed to be the question. And so this one here having nonpolar bonds, this is nonpolar. This one, we've got two different bond styles here. So we've got the carbon hydrogen, which we know is 0.4, which is nonpolar. But we also have a carbon chlorine bond. And the carbon chlorine bond, chlorine, I want to say, is the same electronegativity as nitrogen 3.0. So I think this is 0.5, which comes out at polar. So does the molecule contain polar bonds? The answer is yes. Is the molecule symmetrical such that it is an AX4 where all X's are the same? So I have three hydrogens and one chlorine. So all the X's are not the same. Going back to that flowchart, is the molecule symmetrical such that the dipole moments all cancel? AX2, AX3, or AX4, we are AX4, are all elements the same? No. Molecule is polar. We would expect this molecule to be polar because it's got one different element and the polar bond. The next one, this is an NH, that is not what I wanted to do. This is an NH3. And electronegativity-wise, if we wanted to figure out the electronegativity, the delta electronegativity between nitrogen, which is 3.0 for nitrogen, and 2.1 for hydrogen, is going to equal a difference of 0.9. That is polar. So does the molecule contain polar bonds? The answer is yes. Is the molecule symmetrical Is it an AX3 without an E? See, what happens is the lone pair exerts a downwards force on the rest of the molecule, pushing these bonds down, taking them out of planarity. And the dipole moments no longer cancel when you do that. So in our table up here, or in our flow chart, where we said, is it an AX2, AX3, or AX4, where all elements are the same? We're saying that it cannot be that it has a lone pair in it. The lone pair makes it so that all the dipole moments don't cancel. And so the molecule then, if it has polar bonds, becomes polar. It winds up into the no category, not the yes category. So this molecule is polar. The last one, here what we have is we have two hydrogens and a bromide. We already know that these two are polar bonds. Whatever happens with this one, which is also polar, by the way, isn't going to offset that and the lone pair that's here. It doesn't have the right geometry. It is not an AX3. It has the E in it. That throws things off, and it has polar bonds. That makes this molecule polar. Okay, so I've walked through a bunch of examples there. Hopefully that helps. And it gave us a quick little review on some of the geometries as well in terms of the Lewis structures. Did anything else come up in that while we were going through that, or is everybody else okay? All right, what do we want to do next? Who's got the next question? You guys gonna let me pick? Let's see, let's go back and look at our list. Maybe that'll help. Some fast scrolling. And we could just go through them. Know how to use the group numbers in the periodic table. What information do these provide regarding the number of valence electrons, location of valence electrons, and charge of the ions? Everybody good there? You guys can give me thumbs up if that's looking okay, or you can holler out if that's something you'd like me to look at. I'm not hearing anything, so I'm going to give it a check mark. Compare covalent and ionic bonding with regard to electron transfer or sharing and type of elements involved, metals versus nonmetals. Basically here, we're saying that if a metal is present, metal equals ionic. All nonmetals equals covalent. And I'm going to assume that you guys can. Yeah, Kimberly, we can absolutely do a lab question at the end. I can even stay on a little bit long and we can deal with some lab questions too. Write the correct formulas for the two products of this double displacement reaction. How is that in terms of writing the products? You guys good with the double displacement component?
No, I need some help, please.
Okay, so let's do that. So this is iron 2 chloride reacts with sodium oxide to form iron 2 oxide and sodium chloride. Really, I just need to remember the first half. Iron 2 chloride reacts with sodium oxide. I think that's what we had to produce. I'm writing a little bit too big because I'm not going to be able to fit all this in here. Produces iron 2 oxide. And sodium chloride. Okay, So the first thing to do is when you have a reaction that is written out in this way, to take the name of each species and to write them down with their charge state. And remember that the charge states for these transition metals are given to you as the Roman numeral, because the transition metals can have multiple charge states. In the name, we need to tell you the charge state. The other ones, the fact that this ends in an IDE, the IDE tells you that this is an anion, and we look at the periodic table to determine what the charge state is on that anion. So that's from the periodic table. The periodic table, if we take that, let's see if I can bring this in. Boy, it really wants to drop it in as an image right now. Oh, because I'm on the PNG image rather than a... All right, I'm gonna try one more thing here. File, print. Open preview. Give me a PDF. No, still give me the PNG. I was trying to get a PDF so that it would bring it in the right way. That's okay. We'll go ahead and bring this into Notability. It just brings it as an image, which isn't as nice to work with. But it does size it smaller for me. Okay, so in the periodic table, what we have is by group number, these are all minus one. These are all minus two. These are all minus three. Group 4A shares. These are all plus three, plus two, and plus one. So we can find chlorine in the periodic table and know what its charge state is going to be just by its location in the periodic table. We can do the same for sodium. So we take sodium and we find it in the periodic table, and it's a group 1A, so it's going to be a plus cation. And oxide, oxygen, this one ending in IDE is the anion, and that anion found in the periodic table sits over here in the 2 minus column. So that's a 2 minus. So these guys are, I'll do blue consistently for things that I'm reading from the periodic table. And then again, over here on this side, the iron, which is the 2 plus, that I'm reading from its Roman numeral. The oxide, the sodium, and the chloride. And the charge states do not change from the left-hand side of the table or equation to the right-hand side. And what I do then is I take on balancing. I need to get the same number of charges on each side, plus and minus. And then as I do that, and I get those same number of charges on each side, I can build the formula up above by taking and including the number of elements that are in the formula, Fe, Cl, subscript 2, where the 2 is telling me how many chlorides are needed to balance that equation. Likewise, I need to get 2 positives and 2 minuses for the sodium oxide. So this is then Na2O, where it is 2 here, because there are 2 sodiums that are required for the charge neutrality or the charge balance. Moving forward, these guys, what I find is that they are already balanced, 2 minus to 2 positive. So I simply write them with their element symbols, Fe, O, no subscripts required. Last thing, these guys are also balanced. So it is minus to plus. And so I write NaCl. And that is writing the formula, but the formula needs to be then balanced on both sides of the equation. So what we're going to do is we're going to take and copy this. This is number one, writing the formula. Number two, we're going to balance the formula. In balancing the formula, what we do is we list out each of the elements and we do it in the same order on both sides. And then we count how many of each element are on, that's supposed to be sodium, how many of each element are on each side. And then we use coefficients to change, to increase the number of elements in order to balance it out. And what we said was we start going from left to right and we can balance any element that does not appear more than three times in the equation. If it appears more than three times, skip it. If it's a diatomic, save it for last. So iron is balanced, leave it alone. Chlorine is out of balance, there's two and one. So I need a coefficient on the right-hand side to give me two chlorides. That works for both the chlorine and the sodium. So it gives me two chlorines and two sodiums. And notice that with just that one change, everything now balances 1:1, 2:2, 2:2, 1:1. And we have now balanced the formula. Okay, how's that for a good review in terms of how to write those equations? Christina, I think that was yours. Do you need more than that, or does that seem to give you some direction there?
No, that's awesome. Thank you.
Cool. Okay. Let's go take a look then. So now we have write the correct formulas for double displacement. We have done that. Compare and contrast the naming rules for ionic versus covalent compounds. Be able to correctly write the formula and an ionic compound given its name. Know how to crisscross charges. All right, that makes me nervous. Because we don't always crisscross charges. We only do that when we have odds and evens. And so crisscrossing here for odd and even. So that when I have an odd charge up against an even charge, I can crisscross to figure out the numbers, but I don't always want to crisscross. That gets me into trouble if I always crisscross. Okay, nomenclature review. Do we want to do a quick nomenclature review? So there's two types of nomenclature that we've got. The two types of nomenclature that we have are the ionic nomenclature. In this case, what we do is we always list cation first, anion second. The cation name is generally unchanged, but must include a Roman numeral if it's a transition metal. We can go back and forth between a couple of names and things. And so we could do lead four, hydroxide. In this one, what we have is we have PB, which is a 4+, and hydroxide, which is a polyatomic, which is an OH minus. That the hydroxide must be memorized. There's no other way. So this one is memorized, both its charge and its formula. We balance it for charge, which means that it's going to take four hydroxides in order to get four negative charges against my four positive charges. And that means that there will be four hydroxides in my formula, and I will write the formula PB parentheses, OH, close parens, 4. And I must use parentheses around a polyatomic anytime I have multiple numbers of that polyatomic, because that's very different. This is the 4 here is applying to the hydrogen and the oxygen such that there are 4 hydrogens and 4 oxygens in my formula. If I were to just write it PbOH4, the interpretation there is that the 4 only applies to the hydrogen. And so this would be an incorrect formula. This one, the correct formula, the parentheses need to be there. That type of nomenclature is for any time we have a metal with a non-metal or a polyatomic. So ionic is always about metal. Let's see how I want to do this. Cation is the metal, and the anion is a non-metal or polyatomic. Okay, the covalent nomenclature we call this binary covalent. Here what we do is these are two nonmetals. And so these equations look like CO2 is a perfect one, or CO, or BCl3. And the way that we name these is we name the first as if it were a metal. We just use the name of the element. So this would be carbon. And then we use a prefix that tells me how many of the next element. That prefix is for 2, di. And then we include the name of the element, oxygen, except we change the ending to a suffix that is always the IDE suffix. So it becomes ox, I put the Y in there, but it should have been IDE, oxide. So it always end with the IDE ending. If there is one of the first element, one of the second element, we always use a prefix. So this one, the second one is going to be carbon. Oops, wrong color. Carbon. Our prefix is mon. And then ox for the oxygen, and then the IDE suffix. So carbon monoxide. For the last one, we name it boron for the element. And then 3 is tri. Come on, switch colors. So this is tri. And then chlor is the root for chlorine, C-H-L-O-R. And then we end in the IDE ending. So that would be boron trichloride. So for these binary covalents, we have to use these prefixes that tell you how many of each thing that there are. So when it's 1, that prefix is the mon. When it's 3, it's tri. And our prefixes are mon for 1, di, tri, tetra, penta, hexa, hepta, octa, nona, and deca. So those are all our prefixes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. Okay, so that's a little bit between the ionic nomenclature and the covalent nomenclature, the binary covalent nomenclature, and the differences. And really is the reason that we use all of these prefixes is because there are no charges. And because there are no charges, the prefixes must tell you how to put it back together. Okay, now I'm looking at the time check here. We got about a half an hour, and I'm concerned because some of the biggest things that we get into are down here in the stoichiometry stuff and redox. Although redox isn't as big a topic, it's much more the calculations and how do we go through and do the calculations. And so, understanding electronegativity trends in the periodic table, we sort of covered that. The Lewis structures, we covered that. Understanding the electronegativity trend, we covered that. And so we're at, what is the definition of the mole? Avogadro's number, calculations, sample problems. What do you guys think? What do you want to do?
In the chat, there's someone.
Can we do oxidation and reduction? Yeah, Kimberly, thank you. Christina, that was helpful. Yes, we can do oxidation reduction. Redox. Oxidation reduction is a, is basically a set of man-made rules to track electrons. It's electron bookkeeping. That's what I call it. So this is nothing more than electron bookkeeping. And redox is standing for oxidation and reduction. And I guess the first thing is just to start off with a definition. Oxidation is the loss of electrons. And reduction is the gain. And so the way that I remember this is I pull out the oxidation is loss, and I come up with oil, and reduction is gain, and I come up with Rig. And there are many different ways. Leo the Lion says, grr, there's all kinds of different things that people use to try to keep track of or remember how to figure out what is oxidation and what is reduction. And like I said, it's a bookkeeping system with a set of rules. And so here's our set of rules for assigning oxidation numbers. Set of rules starts off with elements in their elemental state are zero. So examples, iron just written in its elemental state. Sodium in its elemental state, oxygen in its elemental state, which is diatomic, hydrogen, which is diatomic, chlorine in its elemental state, which is diatomic, argon in its elemental state, which is monatomic, or helium, which is monatomic. All of these have oxidation numbers, which are zero, because they are in their elemental state as they appear on the periodic table. Second rule. The second rule is that ions. The oxidation state of an ion is the same as the charge state. So examples here, if I have iron 2 plus or iron 3 plus, or I have sodium plus or oxide 2 minus or chloride minus or let's throw an aluminum in there, 3 plus, then the oxidation states for these guys become plus 2, plus 3, plus 1, minus 2, minus 1, and plus 3. And for my charge states, when I do a charge state, I always put the number in front of the charge because it is two positive charges. But when I do a redox number, I always put the charge in front of the number because I just think of it in a different way and I want to make it different from the charge state itself. So we have the oxidation number and we have the charge state. Okay, next rule. Combined oxygen is always 2 minus. Combined hydrogen is plus 1. And combined fluoride or fluorine is always minus 1. And then and by combined, these are things that are covalently bound. So by combined, the word combined means covalently bound. And the last part of this is for a molecule, the sum of the oxidation numbers I don't know how I got a Y in there, I was thinking about oxygen. Oxidation numbers must equal 0. And for a polyatomic ion, the sum of the oxidation numbers must equal the charge state on the ion. Those are actually technically the same rule because for a molecule, the charge on a molecule is 0. And the charge on a polyatomic is the charge on the ion. And so what we could say is we could combine those into one rule, and we should say that the sum of the oxidation numbers must add to the charge state of whatever it is. And if it's a molecule, it's 0. And if it's an ion, then we know what its charge state is. So these are all of our rules. And we use those rules to take a chemical equation and to identify charge states. And so from here, what we can do is we can take a couple of examples of oxidation reduction reactions, and we can assign charge states and oxidation numbers and then figure out if it's a redox or not. So let's take sort of a classic example, a simple one. Let's take sodium reacting with chlorine to make sodium chloride. And we will require two of those and two of these in order to make the equation balance. And so what we do is we go through and we assign oxidation numbers. And oxidation numbers are assigned based on the rules. So sodium, what I do is I look at this and say, all right, this is a single symbol being written by itself. This is as it appears on the periodic table. This is an element. So this is in its elemental state. Chlorine is also an element. Sodium chloride is an ionic compound. So as an element, sodium is going to have a zero oxidation number. As an element, chlorine is going to have a zero oxidation number. As an ionic compound, sodium chloride is comprised of a sodium cation and a chloride anion. And so for each of these, the charge state is going to be equal to the charge on the ion itself. In other words, sodium is going to be plus one and chloride is going to be minus one. And so I have changes in oxidation states. Sodium, if I remove these guys and get these guys out of the way. In fact, what I'll do is I'll include up here that this was plus and a minus, so that helps me to remember. Sodium is changing in oxidation state, and chlorine is changing in oxidation state. So we have changes in oxidation state, and this defines what a redox reaction is. And what I can do is I can take this one step further, and I can say that sodium is going from a zero oxidation state to a sodium ion where it's in a plus one state. And because of that, in order to balance this chemical equation, I have to add one more electron in. In essence, what I'm saying is that sodium on the periodic table is element number 11. It had 11 protons and 11 electrons being balanced. Over here, this is 11 protons, but only 10 electrons. That's where the charge comes from. So the extra electron that is here makes it so that when I add these together, they add to 11 electrons, the same as the number of electrons over here. And that when an electron is a product, this constitutes a loss. And so that loss, the loss of electrons, oxidation is loss. This is the oxidation. So this half is the oxidation half. On the other side, what I have is I have chlorine going from its zero oxidation state to a two chlorides. Now, if I keep track of the electrons in the same way that I was doing before, I need to make sure I've got enough room up here to do it. And she doesn't usually ask this of you. I'm just trying to make sense of it for you. So chlorine is element 17. So there are two of them. That means that 2 times 17, or what do I have, 34? 34 protons and 34 electrons. But over here, I have 34 protons and two extra electrons, 36 electrons, which means that I need to add two more electrons to this side in order to be able to get 34 plus 2 equals 36. This is a gain of electrons. And so here, electrons as a reactant are gain. Reduction is gain. This is the reduction half reaction, or the reduction side. And so I have the oxidation and I have the reduction. And I think that she asked you one more question, which is to identify the oxidizing agent and to identify the reducing agent. So let's define those. Oxidizing agent. This is the thing or the species that was reduced and caused oxidation. And when I say species, I also mean reactant, not a product. These are always reactants. And the reducing agent . This is the species reactant. That was oxidized and caused reduction. So taking this example that we've got over here and trying to take just the pieces that we need. I think I want to get that line. I might have to do some erasing once we bring it over. Not too bad. Okay, so what we can say here is that because sodium was oxidized, therefore the sodium is the reducing agent. Because chlorine is reduced, that means that the chlorine is the oxidizing agent. Seems like it's a little bit of a double speak or double argument, but that's what we do, is we simply take a look at whatever it was that was reduced, and that thing that was reduced becomes the oxidizing agent. The thing that is oxidized, that thing is the reducing agent. And that's how we describe those, okay? So while I showed it for an entire equation, those rules also imply things like, what if I wanted to take PO4 3 minus and I wanted to figure out oxidation numbers for this thing? Based on the rules, what I could say is that this guy here is combined oxygen. And so based on the rules, it equals a -2 for its oxidation state. For phosphorus, there's no rule. So what I do is I take and I say, and I make a little equation, I say phosphorus plus 4 oxygens, when they add up, must equal the charge on the whole molecule. So I'm taking this value here, and I'm adding up each of the elements and the number of each element. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to replace oxygen. So it's going to be phosphorus plus 4 times the oxidation state of the oxygen must add up to a -3. Or phosphorus -8 must equal a -3. Or phosphorus equals -3 plus 8, or phosphorus equals plus 5. So now I've determined that in terms of my oxidation states, oxygen is -2 based on its rule, and phosphorus is plus 5 using a mathematical equation to sort it out. So even for things that are a little bit more complicated that I don't have rules for, I can still identify what the oxidation state is for that element. Okay, how did we do? Have we sufficiently hit that? I'm trying to not go into super detail and yet giving you everything that I think that you need to survive the exam. I could do one more, Daisy. Yeah. Let's do one that is common that you will frequently see a lot. Combustions. Let's do something like methane, CH4 plus O2 goes to form CO2 plus H2O. Combustion reactions are a form of redox reactions. And let's make sure that this equation is balanced, which I don't believe it is. So we'll balance it quickly. Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. There is 1, 4, and 2. Carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. There is 1, 2, and 3. So I need 2 more of the hydrogens. That gives me 4, and it gives me 2 and 4 of the oxygens, and that means that I need a 2 here. So now I have a balanced chemical equation. Everything checks off. And now that I have a balanced chemical equation, we'll start by assigning redox numbers. So by assigning redox numbers, what I have is some things that I can assign based on rules. I have a rule for combined hydrogen. Combined hydrogen equals plus 1. This is a combined hydrogen where it's combined in a covalent bond. Elements in their elemental state equals 0. Oxygen here is in its elemental state. I can tell that because it is only oxygen. There is no other symbol. There's no other hydrogen or carbon, or there's nothing bound to it. Even though there's 2, it's one of the diatomics. And remember, your diatomics are from Hofbräunkel. Is a word that helps you to remember which elements are diatomic in their elemental state. Some other rules that I have: combined oxygen. Equals minus 2. So here's a combined oxygen, and here's a combined oxygen. Combined hydrogen, here's a combined hydrogen, we said is plus 1. And so the only thing that we don't have yet is we don't have the carbon. And for the carbon, we must then use a formula to determine what its charge state is, because there's no rules. This is a molecule, and the molecule has a net charge of 0. So the oxidation state numbers must add to 0. So I make a little formula, and what I say is carbon plus 4 hydrogens must equal 0. Use the oxidation state for hydrogen, 4 times plus 1 must equal 0. Carbon plus 4 must equal 0, or carbon must equal minus 4 as I subtract 4 from both sides. So I can replace this question mark with a minus 4. And now I can track my oxidation numbers, and I can look to see what was oxidized and what was reduced. So in tracking my oxidation numbers, oxygen went from 0 to minus 2 in 2 locations. And hydrogen stayed plus 1. It did not change, but the carbon went from minus 4. Oh, you know what? We didn't finish carbon. We need to do the carbon in the CO2. So this was the carbon in CH4. Now we need to do the carbon in CO2. I'm realizing as I got there, I hadn't finished it. The formula is carbon plus 2 times oxygen equals the charge on the molecule, which is 0. This is carbon plus 2 times a minus 2 for oxygen equals 0. Carbon minus 4 equals 0, or carbon equals plus 4. So while that was a question mark as well, it is now resolved, and carbon went from minus 4 to plus 4. So I don't have to write the half reactions in order to figure out which thing is losing and which thing is gaining electrons. What I can do is I can say, all right, when I have minus 4, this is an excess of electrons. This is 4 extra. And now I'm going down to 4 less. This is a loss of electrons. Oxidation is loss. This is the oxidation half reaction. Oxygen started off with 0 and it gained 2. Gaining 2, be careful, subtraction, when we see minus, it doesn't mean that it lost. Remember that an electron, I almost like want to write this really big, an electron is negatively charged. And so this negative down here that we see, this is extra electrons, not the loss of electrons, it's the gain of electrons. That's really important, okay? And so reduction is gain, and this is the reduction half reaction. And then I could list the oxidizing agent and the reducing agent. So because methane is undergoing oxidation, it is the reducing agent. So this guy here, methane, is my reducing agent. It is the thing that is causing reduction because it is undergoing oxidation itself. The other species, the thing that is being reduced, it is the oxidizing agent. So this is the oxidizing agent. Okay, how was that for a second example? Kind of fit everything into one there. In a problem that you're likely to see, because those are the typical problems that we like to throw our combustion reactions like that. All right, what else do you guys want to know? Should we go back up and look at the list? See where we're at? So we've now covered oxidation and reduction. How to balance, define redox reactions. So the only thing that we haven't done really is balancing and stoichiometry, because all the rest of these, when I look at all the rest of these, they're all related in stoichiometry. So probably one of the best things that I can do for you in terms of stoichiometry is to remind you of the stoichiometry roadmap. Unlike other problems, stoichiometry problems are very consistent in the way that we attack them. In stoichiometry, the core of stoichiometry is going from moles of A to moles of B. It's the count to count. If I want to compare two things and they weigh different amounts, let's say I'm comparing watermelons and apples. Well, I can't compare watermelons and apples by mass because they weigh differently. They're so different in their masses. However, if I have 10 watermelons and 10 apples, I can say that I have the same number of each. And that's what this mole concept is, of mole A to mole to B. Mole is a counted value. It's a really big number, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd, but it's a counted value. And it allows me to directly compare species that may be of different masses, different sizes. So we compare them in this way. But to get into moles, we always go from grams. So grams of A. And from moles of B, we go to grams of B. And from grams, we can go to other mass units. And from out here, we can go to other mass units. And so this becomes a general roadmap for no matter what they give you, They can give you pounds, they can give you ounces, they can give you kilograms, they can give you micrograms, they can give you whatever they want over here. You can convert them into grams, you can go into moles, moles of B, grams of B, and then if they want other mass units, you can go into other mass units. This piece right here, I refer to it as the mole bridge. And it's the only way across this calculation to be able to go from substance A to substance B in a chemical equation. There are some other things that we can do. For instance, from moles, we can use Avogadro's number and we can go to atoms or molecules. Of A. Or we can come out of here using Avogadro's number into atoms or molecules of B. There are some other inroads. For instance, we covered density, right? So when we talked about density, density was a mass to volume conversion factor, grams per milliliter. And so what I can do is I can come into this grams given milliliters of A. And if I want to, out of the roadmap over here from grams of B, if I have its density, I can go to milliliters of B. And so this is density in grams per milliliter that allows me to do that conversion. And in terms of atoms or molecules over here, this was Avogadro's number. The symbol for Avogadro's number is Na. It's 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. Although I think that Krista only has you remember 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd, but you can use it either way. So Avogadro's number allows us to be able to make that conversion. And from volumes, when we're up here in milliliters of A and milliliters of B, we could go to other volume units. And so we could give you liters or gallons, or other things, other volume units. And what we'll find as we go on in this class is this roadmap gets bigger. There are more inroads and outroads into this roadmap than I have given you, but we just don't have them yet. And as we develop them, we'll add them to this. And this becomes just like your Google map. When you want to go to a friend's house and you've never been there before, you get their address and you figure out where you're going. And you look on the map and you figure out where you are and where you need to go, and you get turn-by-turn instructions. This is your turn-by-turn instructions. All we need to do is take a chemical equation and map it onto this, and then we have our instructions. You guys interested in seeing one? We can do one as an example. Is this helpful? All right, let's see. Let's take a chemical equation and a problem. In fact, let's use the combustion problem that we were using earlier, such that we have a question that says, how much carbon dioxide is formed from the complete combustion of 10.6 grams of methane gas with excess oxygen. The balanced chemical formula, CH4 plus 2O2 goes to make CO2 plus 2H2O. So what I do when I do these problems is I have a setup of the way that I attack them. I parse the word problem. By parsing the word problem, what I do is I take and I identify my given. So my given here is 10.6 grams of methane. So we'll just hit all of this here. And then my desired is how much carbon dioxide. And I'm going to assume because they gave me grams that I'm going to go for grams. And so what I've got then is I've got an amount, as I'm parsing it, 10.6 grams of methane that was given to me. And I want to know how many grams of carbon dioxide. And so stoichiometry wise, this is the calculation that I'm attempting to do. When I go to my roadmap and I look at my roadmap and I bring this all into the same picture, where I'm starting is I'm starting here on my roadmap. Actually, I'm in blue, so let's do blue. You are here, the blue dot, grams of A, and A is methane. So we are in grams of A. Where I want to go is I want to go grams of B. So I'm being asked to go to this spot on my roadmap. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to develop a roadmap that is going to take me the shortest route from point A to point B. And that means that I'm going to go from grams of A to moles of A to moles of B to grams of B. Now I'll formalize that and I'll write that out. I'm going to go from grams of CH4 to moles of CH4 to moles of CO2 and finally to grams of CO2. So I have just replaced A and B with methane and carbon dioxide. And it is the same roadmap. It is just giving me a point A to start and a point B to end. And now I need some other pieces of information. So these arrows each represent conversion factors, and I will need to find or calculate these conversion factors. So the first one here, this roadmap or this arrow represents the molar mass of methane. Oops. The second arrow represents the coefficients. In the equation. And the last one is the molar mass of CO2. So I need the molar mass of methane and I need the molar mass of CO2 before I can begin. Where do I get those? Where do I get those molar masses? I need to get them from the periodic table and I need to do a little calculation. Exactly, Kimberly, from the periodic table. So let's get those molar masses. Let's go and calculate those. For CH4, carbon equals 12.01 grams per mole. And hydrogen equals 1.008. And so when we do the equation to calculate this out, it is 1 times carbon and 4 times hydrogen. So this becomes 4.032. And as I add those up, it becomes 2, 4, 0, and 16. So 16.042, and I need to do my rounding, following my rounding rules, 16.04 grams per mole. So the carbon or the methane, CH4, equals 16.04 grams per mole. For the CO2, we'll do the same thing. As we said, carbon equals 12.01. Oxygen equals 16.00 grams per mole. And so it will be 1 times 12.01 for the carbon and 2 times 16.00 or 32.00 for the oxygen. So I'm at 44.01 grams per mole. So CO2 equals 44.01. Okay, now that we've done that, now we're going to follow our roadmap. And so let's take this roadmap. Let's take the whole thing so that we can put it down here and follow it with the information that we've now got. What did I start with? 10.6? Yep, 10.6 grams. All right, 10.6 grams of CH4 times a conversion factor. Grams goes in my denominator. My desired moles goes in my numerator. And for every 1 mole of CH4, we calculated that it was 16.04 grams. Now, we go through the stoichiometry of the equation. We need to go back and look at the coefficients for the equation. We want, in the bottom, we're going to have moles of CH4. And in the top, we're going to have moles of CO2. And we need to go and look and figure out what this ratio is based on the coefficients in the balanced chemical equation. So here's our equation. It is 1 CH4 to 1 CO2. So they are a 1-to-1 ratio. 1 mole CO2 to 1 mole CH4. Last conversion factor. For every 1 mole of CO2, I get a certain number of grams of CO2, and that grams comes from its molar mass, 44.01. And now what I'll do is I'll just check and make sure I did everything right. Grams to grams of CH4, moles to moles of CH4, moles of CO2 to moles of CO2, and in my numerator, I've got grams of CO2. I have done all my conversion factors correctly. Now I pull out the calculator and I punch those in. 10.6 divided by 16.04 times 1 divided by 1, so I'm going to ignore that, times 44.01. This equals 29. So I'm at 29.08391512 grams. I can't get to my, there we go. 212 grams. And sig figs, I always go back and do sig figs last. This was 3, 4, 4. My smallest number is 3. So I do my rounding at 3. So this becomes 29.1 grams CO2 produced. And that is how we do it. So that sort of encompassed everything within stoichiometry and gave you a good overview of how we would go through and do that, and also gets that stoichiometry roadmap in there, which is really critical. Parsing the problem, using the chemical equation as your template to write down your information under so that you parse the word problem from a word problem into a graphic so that you know what you're doing, work from the general roadmap, construct your roadmap, calculate your molar masses as you need to, write out your equation, do your math, check your sig figs, do your rounding. How's that? Nice. Okay, We're a little out of time. I went over a little bit. I know that I had a question from somebody about lab, and if you want to stay on the line, I'm going to cut the recording here and call it good here, and then I'll stay on the line if anybody has any further questions and you want me to do anything more. I'm happy to stay online for a little bit longer and support you guys, but I think I should stop the video here at this point, all right? I'm going to wish everybody who's watching the video good luck in your exam. I hope you guys just knock it out of the park, and happy studying. All right, take care, everybody. Let's see.